The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache dalla galassia.
Signore e signori, è con grande piacere che abbiamo qui per la seconda volta un attore che ci ha chiesto di tornare. Noi abbiamo accolto molto volentieri la sua proposta di tornare. Vi renderete conto, le persone che sono state qui, Claudio sta zitto, Cherubini zitto, e, vi renderete conto dall'ultima volta che è diventato ancora più simpatico. Quindi, ladies and gentlemen, Garrett Wong.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Okay. Let's see if this is any good. Ready? Okay. Sono felice di essere tornato in Italia dopo 17 anni. Is that pretty good?
You have to know that Garrett is wonderful, especially for being American, because he's one of the few Americans who speaks 5 languages.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but not Italian yet. I'm trying to learn Italian now, so thank you. Okay, so who was here when I was here 17 years ago? 1, 2, 3, 4,
you see?
5?
Only 5.
Only 5.
So, lots of new people.
Well, hello to all the new people who were not here 17 years ago. I can't believe
it's
been 17 years. It's, is that how you say it? 17 anni? Yeah? Okay. With two S's and two T's. 17 anni. Yeah. Okay, I'm trying. So yes, I have missed Italy. I'm so happy to be here again. And you know, for me, I was very lucky to get on Star Trek. I was 24 years old when I first got the job on Star Trek, and it was very exciting for me because I had not done many jobs before this. This was my very first big job. I did a small job on a comedy, a half-hour comedy, called All American Girl was the name of it. It was a very short run of this TV series. And then while I was working on that show, which was for Disney, I found out that I had got the role of Ensign Kim on Voyager. So I was so excited, and my manager, my talent agent, he told me, you have to go to Paramount Studios today after you're finished at Disney, because they have to measure you for your uniform, for your Starfleet uniform. But you have to be there today. So I said, well, I'm going to have to rush and drive from Burbank, California to Hollywood, California. And in traffic, this can take up maybe even an hour. It's so bad, the traffic. So I was speeding over to the studio, to Paramount Studios, and I came to the front gate, and the security guard there, he saw me and he recognized me, and I had, every time I had come for an audition, which was five total auditions before I got the job of Harry Kim, I was talking to the same security guard, and he kept telling me, he said, I know you are going to be Harry Kim. And I look at him and I say, no. He goes, yes. I go, no, see. So I back and forth. And so this time I drive in and he goes, ah, you're Harry Kim. And I go, see, I'm Harry Kim. And so I said, I'm late. I have to come to the wardrobe fitting for my costume, for my Starfleet uniform. He said, I said, where should I park? He goes, okay, you need to park in this area over here. And it's crowded. There's a lot of cars there, but you should find one space or two. So go ahead. And so I drove in there, and I was speeding around the corner, and I drive around another corner. And all of a sudden, this man walks between two cars in front of my car. So I slam on the brakes. I'm like, ah! And my heart is beating so fast. I'm like, and then this guy is like, ah! And I look up, and he looks at me, and it's Harrison Ford. And then I thought, oh my God.
I almost killed
Harrison Ford. Han Solo, Indiana Jones. And I love Star Wars, and I love everything that he's done, really, all his roles. And I looked at him, I said, I'm sorry. And he goes, it's okay. And he was going to a screening of a movie, Clear and Present Danger was the movie that he was going to the screening for. So he was wearing a nice suit and a tie. And I kept thinking, I almost killed him, you know, the previous day, which would have been a very bad beginning to my role as Ensign Kim. Everyone would have known, oh yes, that guy, he killed Harrison Ford. Yes.
The parking space.
Yes, I did. I found a parking space. Yes, it was good. It was good. But yes, this was a wonderful time for me to be able to get on a television show, and I worked on there for seven long years on Voyager. And the first time that I did a convention was on January 16th of 1995 was when Voyager premiered on United Paramount Network in the United States. And so that was Monday. My first Star Trek convention was Saturday. So 5 days later, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. 5 days later, I was in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I don't know if anyone here has been to the United States, to Minneapolis in January, you know, with this area, Minneapolis, Illinois, all these Midwest states are very, very cold. Yeah, extremely cold. The kind of cold where Minneapolis cold is like, you think if you go outside that anything that has liquid, like your eyeball will freeze, you know, your spit will freeze, everything will freeze. So it was very, very crazy. But that was the first convention that I went to because Kate Mulgrew, Captain Janeway, was the guest. She was the guest, but she canceled because she was sick. She said, I can't do it. So they called me up and said, will you fill in? Will you be the guest since Janeway cannot come to Minneapolis? I said, okay. So I get there, and I did not know what to expect. I honestly thought that maybe there would be a small number of fans there, maybe less than 100, you know, similar to this, like a smaller room like this. And so they told me I have one panel and I have one autograph session. And I said, okay, so what time is the panel? He said, the panel is at 1 p.m. or 1300 hours. And we will send somebody to your hotel room to come collect you, to pick you up, to take you to the panel. Because the hotel was located away from the convention center. But Minneapolis, in the downtown area, they have these walkways that go between each building, so you don't have to freeze your butt off, so you can go from building to building to building. So I get a knock on the door, and this man that is at the door is the head of security for Creation Conventions, you know, and he's wearing a suit, and he has a little wire there, like he's Secret Service, you know, and CIA, and he says, he goes, "Hello, Mr. Wong. My name is Keith Ortiz. I'm the head of security for Creation. I'm here to escort you to your panel, to your talk." And I said, "Thank you." So we started walking. And then he started talking to people in his little microphone. And he was, "Eagle One to base, come in, please."
Yeah, this is base. Go ahead, Eagle One.
"Yes, I have the package. I have Mr. Wong. We are now walking towards the convention." So, okay. Eagle One to Eagle Two. "Eagle Two here, go ahead. Do you have eyes on us?" "Yeah, we got eyes on you." Where are the eyes? I don't see anybody. So we keep walking. He's talking to everybody. And right when we get to the convention center, I ask the head of security, Mr. Keith Ortiz. I said, "Keith, how long will I be on the in the panel?" He says, "You will be speaking for approximately 1 hour." And I said, "Well, I have to go to the bathroom now." So, so at this point, he had already told the base, he goes, "I have Mr. Wong, we're outside the doors, we're ready to go." They copy that, and then I ask the question, "How long?" He says, "At 1 hour." "Oh, I have to go to use the washroom, the bathroom." So he goes, he looks at me, he goes, "No, you may not." "No?" He goes, "No." I go, "Yes," and I start running away from him. And now he starts running after me, and he's like, in his, "Abort, abort, Mr. Wong is no longer at the door, abort, the mission has failed, the mission has failed." So he follows me into the bathroom. So now I am in the bathroom, and I'm doing my business, and he's standing right next to me, you know. "Yes, Mr. Wong is doing his business." "No, I did not look at it. I'm just waiting for him to finish." And I look at him, "Do you want to help me? I don't know. What are you doing?" You know? So finally, I go, "Okay, I'm ready." So he goes, "Mr. Wong has finished using the bathroom. He is finishing pee-pee. He is ready to go." So we walk into the front door. And he says, "Mr. Wong is at the door. Okay, cue the announcer." And then you hear, "Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Mr. Garrett Wong, Ensign Harry Kim from Star Trek Voyager." They open the door and I walk in. There is over 5,000 people inside this room. And I look at everybody and I look at Keith Ortiz and I'm so nervous. I said, "I think I have to go pee-pee again right now." He goes, "You can't. You go, 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 go." So I get on stage, and I'm so nervous. I'm really, my body is shaking. You know, when some other people, when you have to do public speaking in front of a crowd, in front of an audience, you feel nervous. But in front of 5,000, over 5,000 people, you're very nervous. So I got on the microphone, and I thought to myself, Garrett, okay, calm down. It's okay. It's okay. And then I'm still nervous. And I thought, I can do one of two things. I can, number one, try to push my fear down, you know, get the nerves and the fear away and ignore it. Or I can acknowledge my fear and my nervousness and talk to all the fans about it. So I chose option number two. Because anytime you try to push your fear down, it makes it worse, okay? It is worse. So that is a lesson to everybody here. Confront your fear, confront your nervousness, do not push it down. So I grabbed the microphone and I said, whoa, oh my goodness, I can't believe how many people are here. I'm so nervous, my body is shaking. And the minute I said I'm nervous, oh my goodness, and people were you know, they were laughing when I said, whoa, my whole, everything about me calmed down immediately. So I became my normal self. I wasn't nervous anymore. And I began my conversation, my panel. I took some questions. And that was the very first Star Trek convention. And this happened before any other Star Trek Voyager actors had gone to. I was the first one, the very first one. And then I went on to do about 17 or 18 more conventions in the United States, different cities, before anyone from Voyager did one. So even though I am the youngest Starfleet member of Voyager, I felt like I was Yoda, the wise person of Voyager, yes. Do you want to ask for questions?
Yes, yeah. No, I have a few questions for you.
Sure.
So basically, if you didn't imagine that you were going to be greeted by 5,000 people. Mm. You were not a Star Trek fans before working on Voyager, were you?
I was.
But
I didn't go to conventions. I never saw a convention before. I was a fan of all science fiction. So when I was young, I saw 1977 Star Wars in the movie theater when I was 8 years old, and then at home after school, I would watch reruns of the original series, Star Trek original series with Kirk and Spock and Sulu, of course. and this is important for me because growing up in America, you don't see a lot of faces, at least I did not see a lot of faces that were Asian. I only saw other people. And so when I saw George Takei for the first time, I was very excited because he plays a regular person. He's not, he doesn't have an accent, anything. He's from Asia, from Japan. He speaks with a very good voice, and he has a very nice low voice, you know, very masculine, right? And so for me, it was someone that I looked up to. You know, I would watch him on the original series, on the bridge, saying, Warp 8. Warp 9. And it was just, it made me feel so proud. You know, I'm like, yeah, this is so cool. So, yeah, I've always been a fan of all science fiction, whether it's Star Wars, Star Trek, Battlestar Galactica, original, new Battlestar Galactica. Anything new that comes on, I watch as well, you know, so I love it all. I love everything.
And probably you were also very proud because in Star Trek you were you were the new generation of Asian, you know, after George Takei.
Yes, I was, because if you think about the original series had George Takei, but then Next Generation did not have an Asian man, right? There was the nurse.
Yes, sure.
Keiko.
Keiko,
yeah. There was a nurse, but there was no Asian men there. DS9, again, no Asian men, right? Deep Space Nine. And then Voyager, finally, we have someone else. But it's funny, I was dating this one girl from Arizona, and she told her mom that, oh yes, I'm dating the actor, the Asian actor from Star Trek. So the mother told all her friends, like, my daughter is dating the Asian actor from Star Trek. And they all said, Sulu? Well, Sulu Not so much. No, yeah.
Okay. And so I know that you are very proud of your parents being Chinese.
Yes.
So can you tell us why they left China and then decided to go to the United States? Because you were born in the United States,
yes.
But you still have a strong connection with China, right?
Yeah, well, definitely. My parents were very young when they left China. They were 3 and 4 years old. This was during the World War II era. And at the time, China was having a civil war. The communists and the non-communists, basically, were fighting, and the communists took over China. So my parents were one of the 1 million Chinese that left mainland China to go to Taiwan. So they landed in Taiwan, but in Taiwan, there were already Chinese living there that call themselves Taiwanese, and they were not happy that 1 million new Chinese showed up in their land. Can you imagine that? If 1 million people came into Italy, like, hello, we're here, you know, you'd be like, what the hell? So this is kind of a problem because there was another civil war that happened between Taiwanese Chinese and the new Chinese that came in. But my parents both grew up in Taiwan. They were not born there. And then my father received a scholarship to go to university to get his master's degree at University of California, Riverside, in botany. So then he went there, and I was born in Riverside, California. And then he received another scholarship to go to university at Purdue University in Indiana, also in botany. So he received his PhD in botany. So he became basically a plant pathologist or a plant doctor is what I would say. So then his first job offer was in the island of Bermuda. So that's where I first went to in Bermuda. And this was crazy because Bermuda's in the British Commonwealth. So all the schools there, they're British schools. So I went from being born in America to going to Bermuda and starting school in Bermuda with British teachers. I had a British accent, and I spoke like this. Hello, I'm British, you know, and it was so funny that this Chinese kid had, you know, had an American accent, a British accent. And after 6 years in Bermuda, we moved again to Memphis, Tennessee, and this was a shock to me, because if anyone here has been to the United States in the South, this is a completely different area. They talk completely different. Because if you're in the South, they talk, they stretch all their vowels out, like, you know, light, night, bright. It's just, that's how people talk there. And it's just, it sounds like a country person, you know, is what Americans think. They're like, whoa. So I went from, hello, talking like this, to light, night, brat. So I went from a British school to a Southern school. Went to high school in Memphis and then graduated, went to UCLA. So I went back to college, and that's when I started taking acting classes. So that's the beginnings of my acting.
And why did you choose to take acting?
I chose acting because ever since I was a very young child, one of my favorite things to do is to impersonate people. I don't know if Italy has a famous impersonation person. They probably do. In America, this person's name is Rich Little. Rich Little could do 1,000 voices. Like every president of America, he could do perfectly. Every famous movie star, this person could impersonate. And like, who is the guy in Italy who can impersonate everybody?
Well, we used to have Alighiero Noschese a long, long time ago. Yeah. Then we had, well, today I would say Guzzanti. We have many of them.
Yeah. Yeah, but everyone loves watching it.
All the Guzzanti family.
They all do it, right?
Four people.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. The whole family impersonates? Yes. Oh, that's very cool. But yeah, but everyone loves watching impersonators because it's almost like magic. You know, it's like, oh my goodness, your voice is exactly like the voice that you're doing. And it's kind of cool. So this was something that I enjoyed doing when I was a child, trying to impersonate family, friends, you know, relatives, uncles, aunts. I always did the impersonations. Sometimes I will get into trouble because I'll call a friend pretending. I called my one friend pretending to be her husband, you know. and they're from Michigan. And in Michigan, if I say the name Tony, I say Tony. But in Michigan, it's Tony. It's this very nasally sort of, you know, different accent. So I called up Jennifer and I go, hey, Jen, it's Tony. And they've been together as a couple for many years. They've only had two arguments in 20 years. And one of the two times they were arguing was when I called her. And she said, Tony, where are you? I'm like, it's Garrett. She's like, oh my God. She goes, Garrett, I thought you were Tony. I'm so mad at him. We're in an argument right now. So I got in trouble for that one. So yeah. But this is why I got into acting, because I felt that doing characters and impersonating people was a natural stepping stone to become an actor. And I felt that was the most logical career for me, is try to do characters as an actor.
Well, but at this point, I think this audience expects you to impersonate a few Star Trek actors.
Okay. Well, okay. So I just did George Takei. You know that one. I mean, the key with George is his voice does this, you know. So if I say, oh my, I just say, oh my. But if George says, oh my, it's, oh my. So it goes up and then it falls down. You know, this is his voice. From Voyager, if you're going to do Tom Paris is, his voice is higher. It's higher and it's breathier. He's like, yes, ma'am. So that's how Tom Paris would say, yes, ma'am, you know, whereas Harry Kim would say, yes, ma'am. So Harry has a lower voice. And this was something that I did not know that, you know, when I went to Germany, and same thing in Italy, Florida has a lot of translation or dubbing of television shows and movies from English to Italian, and the Germans also do this. So they took all of Star Trek Voyager and dubbed it into German. And they try to find people with voices similar to the actors on the show. And except for my voice and Tom Paris's voice, they gave Tom Paris a very low, low voice. So he's like, "Hi, Captain." I'm like, what? That is not his voice. Yes, ma'am. No. And they give me the high voice. I'm like, yeah, Capitan, ich habe. Like, I'm going through puberty. You know, I'm turning 15 years old. So I talk like this. Like, this is my voice in German. And I was so angry when I heard that. I'm like, oh, that's not it. That's not the way to go.
You had a very good dubber in Italian.
The Italian voice is good. What's his real name?
Alessio Cigliano, you know? Alessio Cigliano, he's one of the...
Alec is his first name?
Alessio.
Alessio.
Double S, Alessio.
Oh, Alessio. Okay, I got to double S it.
Si.
Oh, can you hear it? Can I hear it?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
It's going to come.
Oh, good. That's awesome.
So in the meantime, and what about Marina that we had here?
This fan, well, I'll tell the story about that fan. Yeah, there was a fan on the Star Trek cruise that came up to me. She said that she was on a cruise with Star Trek cruise 3 years ago with Marina Sirtis, Troy, and this fan was wearing an American football jersey for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and Marina was running to an appointment. She was late, and then she saw the jersey, and she runs back to the fan, and she said, you know, I hate your team, telling this girl that she hates her football team. That's all. And then she ran away. So then the fan came up to me, and she told me this story. I said, were you hurt, upset by it? She goes, oh, no, I laughed about it. Like, me and my brother, we make jokes every day. We pretend to be Marina Sirtis, and we say things like, I hate breathing. I don't like air. I hate it. I hate all of it. And so they do this whole character of how they hate everything, which is hilarious. Janeway's voice is interesting because it depends on how many cigarettes she's been smoking, right? So this is why she has the voice that she does. In the beginning of Star Trek Voyager, season one, there were a lot of fans who stopped watching Voyager because they couldn't listen to Kate's voice. It was too much.
So to do Janeway is much, it's much more, it's sort of like Katharine Hepburn mixed with Smurf. at the same time. The cartoon Smurf. Or at a child's birthday party when you take the helium from a balloon and you inhale it and you start talking like a munchkin.
So that's Janeway's voice. She does not like that I do her voice like this. She's very upset, so, yeah. Yeah, it is what it is. Did you find it? Oh, he's finding the link.
Almost there. Okay, in the meantime, if somebody has a question, we're going to take it. Vai, Emanuele. Se vuoi in inglese, se no gliela traduco io. Vai.
Yeah, so he's saying, would it be more Starfleet to explore more territory instead of going back home? Yeah, I think that would be more Starfleet, but I think because we were thrown to Delta Quadrant, everyone was, you know, the whole show was trying to get back home. But if you remember the American show Gilligan's Island, do you remember this show? They finally got back home, and then they got lost again the next day. And I thought, this can happen to Voyager. We can all come back home and then get lost and end up in fluidic space with species 8472 or something.
He found it.
He has it? Oh, okay. Oh, just to hear. Okay.
Just the voice, okay.
Capitano, i sensori a lungo raggio rilevano una traccia di transcurvatura. Distanza 5.8 anni luce. In avvicinamento.
Allarme rosso.
Manovre evasive.
Cosa succede?
Siamo fuori dalla curvatura.
Lancia alla macchina, che succede?
Non lo so, capitano. Una turbolenza subspaziale ci impedisce di creare un campo di curvatura stabile.
La turbolenza è in aumento.
Rilevo due vascelli Borg. Mi correggo, sono tre. Quattro. No, cinque.
No, cinque.
Sono 15 vascelli Borg. Distanza 2.1 anni luce in diminuzione.
Scudi al massimo, convogliare tutta l'energia alle armi.
Sono nel raggio visivo.
Sullo schermo.
Wow.
What
wow.
Do you think about it?
I think it's good, not bad. But they still made Paris a lower voice than Carrie in this one. Paris has a lower voice.
Yes, but that's because in Italian, if you... Well, that's another stereotype, but if you... are a man and you have a high voice, it sometimes can be considered...
Not so good.
No.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, no, yes, and I also too, because unfortunately the actor dubbing Tom Paris died after 2 years.
Oh, no.
Yes.
So then someone knew how to switch in to do his voice? Oh, my goodness.
Which, of course... Well, it was an emergency, of course, so they had to do it. But for Italian fans, was really important because they be accustomed to you. You know.
Yeah, they become accustomed to the other voice.
Yes.
So people were upset when the new voice came in, probably.
And that's interesting because have you heard the voice of Janeway?
Yeah, that Janeway is not hello. She's isn't. It's different.
Yes, but I know. The dubber, I mean, the actor, she's very good.
Yeah.
And she had to change her voice to make it a little more similar to Kate
Jane
Mulgrew.
To Kate, yes.
But, you know, for us, the voice of Kate Mulgrew was so ridiculous that she tried to change it a little bit. And so it was a problem.
Well, yeah. So it's very interesting because there is one season where Kate's voice sounds much better than every other episode. And that's because for that 1 year, she stopped smoking, you know, because it really, that's what her voice is. It's a woman's smoking voice, you know, and everyone knows if a woman smokes a lot,
eventually it's going to sound like this, you know, this very... Oh, give me another cigarette.
You know, this is a 85-year-old woman that smokes too much. And Janeway quit smoking, and her voice sounded like an angel. It was very beautiful for a while.
And then it went back to this.
And did you have to take breaks during rehearsal because she had to smoke?
During Oh, she smoked.
Oh, sorry. During
filming? No, she always, you know, smoked in her trailer or some in her. Yeah.
During the breaks,
her own breaks. We didn't have to wait for her to smoke. Yeah. Yeah. And that, at that time, I also smoked cigarettes. I don't anymore, but I did as well. And a lot of, oh, I remember Robbie McNeil's young daughter. She was at the studio, and she was walking past the soundstage, and she saw me with a cigarette in my hand, and she goes, oh, no, not you. And she was so upset. I was like, and I threw it down. I didn't want this little girl to think badly that I was smoking cigarettes. So sad.
Altre domande? Sì, che ci sono altre domande. E fate una domanda, su. Matteo, tu hai una domanda, scommetto. Gino, dov'è Gino? Dai. Yes, the joke that you were saying, the fact that you impersonated your friend and his wife.
No,
a Gino, non si capisce, dimmelo in italiano. the girlfriend at your time said your mother, tell the mother that she was dating a Star Trek actor. She thought it was Sulu. So.
Yeah.
Sulu knows about that?
No, he does not know. Sulu does not know about that. No, no. It's funny. I was at a there was a dinner for an organization in Los Angeles, and it's an Asian organization. It's called the Organization of Chinese Americans, so OCA. And they asked me to be the host of their annual dinner banquet, and it was myself and an actress named Lauren Tom, who's she was in Joy Luck Club. She did very, very, very good. So a lot of roles. She's done many, many, many good roles. And so we were co-hosting this dinner. And after the dinner was done, they were going to begin the awards program. And so they told us to come up and start the program. So we're standing at the podium. And Lauren Tom, whose voice is very, very tiny, very small, and she's like,
hello? We're about to start the program.
And nobody listens to her. They're still eating and clinking glasses.
excuse me, hello, we're about to start the program.
Again, no one listens to her. So I said, Lauren, I think we need a little bit of George right now. She goes, what do you mean? Let me have the microphone. So then I impersonated George Takei's voice. I said, would everyone please stop what you're doing? Stop eating, stop drinking. We're about to begin the program now. And then, quiet. Completely quiet, except for one person sitting at a front table, George Takei. He's laughing because I'm impersonating him. So that was the best.
So I guess you have a very good relationship with George.
Yeah, I think so, definitely. George saw me in a play. A lot of people don't know this, but when Japan bombed Hawaii, Pearl Harbor, the U.S. Navy, then almost overnight, the President of the United States signed an order 9066. 9066 was a federal order saying all Japanese Americans living on the West Coast of America, so Washington, Oregon, and California, if you were from Japan or you had Japanese parents, you had to report to a certain area, and then they transported you and your family to a camp, and you lost your business, your farm, your house, everything, unless you had friends who were, Irish or a white American, Caucasian Americans, to take over your business to help you. But most people lost everything, and they were sent to these concentration camps, and George Takei was 4 years old when he was sent to that camp. Now, when I was at UCLA, I did a stage play, and that play was called 12-1A, and this was a barrack number at one of the camps. So I played a Japanese a son in a Japanese family that was interned during World War II. And George actually came to that performance, so he watched me acting on stage when I was in university before I even, you know, came into the real world of acting. So George has known me for a long time. Yeah.
Un'altra domanda, Andrea?
Oh, yeah. So my beginning, I started to study to become an actor at UCLA. I was pre-med to begin with, so I was biology major, thinking I was going to be a doctor like every other Chinese kid in America. And then I did not go that route. I decided to take theater classes at UCLA. So I studied at UCLA, and then I went on to find other acting teachers outside of UCLA. Because when you study drama, if theater is your major in university in America, they call that like conservatory training. So you learn voice for the actor, you learn movement for the actor, stage combat for the actor. But this is all for stage. It's for theater. It's for stage performances, not for film or television. And that's completely different. So to find training for film and TV and other, you know, types of training outside of university, you must go to other teachers. And so I did. I took lessons in improv, improvisational comedy. This is very important. Like if most people, they go to the gymnasium and they're lifting weights to build their muscles. Actors can go to improvisational workshops. Because it is like going to the gym. Instead of building your muscles, you're building your brain. How fast your brain will work, you know. And this is something that's important because sometimes when you are auditioning for a role, a director might say, "Well, okay, let's forget about the script. We're not going to look at this. I want you to improvise." And I want you to be able to come up with something, you know, off the cuff. And this is something that helps you as an actor, because if you're able to think quickly on your feet, sometimes this is the difference of how you get the job, you know. And I'll give you an example. Hello, Emilio. May we help you?
Sì, so qua.
Okay.
I was just saying that David has arrived, but I'm here with you.
Yeah, you are here with me.
No, okay. You're
So to give you an example of how improv training helped me, I was at a commercial audition. This commercial audition was for Big Red chewing gum. This is a chewing gum that tastes like cinnamon, you know, and it was a big advertising campaign. And so I came to the callback audition. So I had one audition, and maybe they saw 600 actors. And then the second audition, from 600 to 80. So there are only 80 now. And in the second audition, they had the actors come in, and we sat down on a stool. There were five stools there, and the five actors were sitting down. And then the guy running the audition had a camera, a video camera, trained on each actor. And he says, "Welcome, actors. Congratulations, you made to round two. There are only 80 of you now. I'm going to record this audition on my video recorder. And there's a wire, and it's attached to a monitor. And to the right, there was a screen set up, so you couldn't see who was sitting there. But he told us, all the people that work for Wrigley's, the chewing gum company, they're here. The advertising executives for the advertising company, they're here. So five people were sitting watching us live on a screen. So he says to everyone, he says to all the actors, the guy running the commercial audition, he says, "I'm going to ask each of you one question, and I want you to answer it in your normal voice. Don't try to be commercial acting, like smiley, super smiley. Just be your normal self." So the first actor, he said, "Please tell me, how long have you been in LA?" And this person was like, "Oh, I've been here for this long. And how do you like it?" "Oh, I like it a lot." The second actor, he said, "What are your hobbies? What do you like to do?" He says, "Oh, I like to go fishing. I like to do this. I like to do that." And then he goes to me. He said, "Where are you from?" I said, "California, Indiana, Bermuda, Memphis, Tennessee, back to California." And the guy running the audition said, "Oh, military brat, right? Your parents are in the military, in the army." And I said, with my improv training, my improvised training, I looked at the camera and I said, no. I said, actually, my parents are heroin importers, and we have stayed one step ahead of the law instead of... So I'm saying that my parents are drug dealers, right? And we've always been running away from the police and the FBI, right? The minute I said heroin importers, the guy running the commercial, he looks at me like he wants to kill me. He's like, He does this move, like, how dare you? How dare you ruin my audition by saying that? And I can sense all the other two actors here. Their heads all turn to me like, are you crazy? You're going to talk about heroin? So I look at the camera after I said heroin importers. We have stayed one step ahead of the law with a flat, straight face. And then I turned into a smile. My smile was saying, just kidding, I'm joking, you know? And then I look at the office screen next to the guy. It's moving. They are laughing so hard. They're like, ha! They loved it because no one had the nerve to say something like this. And I said it. And then I walked out of that audition, and within 30 minutes, my agent called me. Oh, yeah, you booked it. They booked you. Yeah. They want you. You made them laugh. I don't know what you did, but they love you, so you're going to do that. So that commercial ran for 2 years, actually. So, yeah, a lot of fun.
Gabriella.
Some what on the set? Improvisation? Oh, no. Those scripts were very, very... You have to say everything that was in the script. If you want to change one word, you have to call to the office and say... And the only time we ask to change something is... Because I feel that as a writer, a lot of these writers, they're writing on, you know, on a word processor or typewriter, whatever they're writing on. They don't say the dialogue out loud while they're typing it. So sometimes they will write something that becomes, in English we say, a tongue twister, so that you cannot even speak it properly because it's so crazy. So every now and then I would call up to the office and I would say, can you take out one word here or add something here to make the flow of this dialogue easier, you know, because it's so difficult to say this without your tongue getting tangled up. So yeah, we never really got the chance to improvise on the show, unfortunately.
And correct me if I'm wrong, the script that you brought for the charity auction, yeah. The different color of the different things,
yes.
Are the changes,
yes,
right?
Right. So the script that I brought for the charity auction, there are other color, different color pages in there besides white. There's other different colors. Each color is a revision. So while we're filming, if they decide to change something in a scene, they will send down the new dialogue, the new lines in a different color. So white is the first one. Then it goes to like a yellowish color, then green, then blue. So there's probably 35 different colors of paper they will use to give new revisions, a new dialogue and changes, last second changes to the actors.
And between one shot and the other, how much time did you have to learn by heart all your, you know, lines?
Wow. You know, let's say we were beginning the filming of an episode, a new episode on Tuesday. We would get the script on Monday night, so not much time, really. And I was not happy about. I always felt, you got to give us a little bit more time. But those writers were just, you know, always changing things all the time. So very last minute.
And plus, being an ensign, you also had many lines with techno bubbles.
Oh,
did you love it, hate it?
I didn't hate it, but I felt that I should be paid more money than everyone else on Voyager because I had the most techno babble. So I felt like my job was more difficult than Tom Paris's job. My job was more, but instead I was, because this was my first series as a regular, I was the lowest on the payment pole. I was on the very, very bottom. basically, because I had no other, what they call as quotes. So if you're an actor that is very established, your manager can say, oh, Robbie McNeil, Tom Paris, the last time he was a series regular, they paid him this much. So you must try to pay him close to what he worked, what he was paid in 4 years ago. But me, this was my first job, so they were able to say, this is his first job, we're going to give him this, and you will be happy about that. And
the Godfather, yeah, you're a proposal you can't refuse.
Yeah, this is a proposal you can't refuse. But to be honest, I even told my manager, I said, look, you know, we need to do what we can to try to get this pushed a little bit higher, just to be fair, because it really was. When we filmed on the bridge, I was the first one there, and I was the last one to leave. So when we filmed on the bridge, they would then say, oh, Garrett, Kate's tired. Can we send her home? I'm like, okay, send her home. So then someone else reads Kate's dialogue. And then after Chakotay films his close-up, they're like, Robert Beltran is also, he has a long day tomorrow. Can we send him home? Okay, send him home. So at the very end, everyone's gone. Tuvok is gone, Paris is gone, Janeway is gone, Chakotay is gone. It's just Harry Kim. Because they would start from Janeway and Chakotay and then go clockwise around the bridge. So in Janeway, Chakotay, Paris, Tuvok, Kim. That's how they film all the close-up. And I kept thinking, if we were in Australia, maybe we would go backwards. Anyone watch Farscape? Farscape. Sure. I love Farscape. One of my favorite things, if you don't turn on the Italian dubbing, if you just listen to the English, okay? Whenever the guest stars are on Farscape, the guest star alien, they all have heavy Australian accents, right? They come in, they're like, g'day, how are you, mate? And it's like, oh my gosh, this alien is speaking like he's from, you know, straight from the Crocodile Dundee School of Acting, right? So, very funny.
But maybe the best character in Farscape is the puppet.
Oh, Rigel? You think
that's
the puppet
Rigel.
Is the best character? Really? Okay.
No, I don't think so. But it's very funny how the manage. First of all, I think it's really interesting how to manage to make a wonderful TV series with a puppet inside and not seems, you know, like the Muppet Show.
Correct,
like
that. Yes.
And by the way, it was Jim Henson.
Yes. But also, if you think about Farscape, the ship that they are in is a live ship.
Yes, sure.
Now, I always felt that they took the idea in Voyager, we have bioneural gel packs, we have live organisms, I guess, to help make everything to happen faster, you know, with these bioneural gel packs. And I almost felt like the creators of Farscape saw that and they thought, hey, let's do, you know, so a lot of sci-fi will borrow from other sci-fi, I think, which is cool. I'm okay with it, but I really love Farscape a lot.
I love it too. Yeah. I was the one who brought Farscape in Italy, actually.
Did you?
Because I loved the series, and I went to a satellite channel director, and I said, look, this is really good. I think you should get it.
So you brought it into Italy then. Wow, that's great.
Yeah, I was very happy about
it. Good job. Yeah.
Okay. You know that already, so. Un'altra domanda?
Oh, yes, okay. When you turn off your Belgian, do you speak French then? Or?
I'm a Dutch person.
Yes.
So I always watch everything in the original.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
that's people,
of course, Flemish, Dutch, French,
yeah.
English, German.
So yeah. Yeah. My first trip to Europe was in 1995, and I flew on Lufthansa from LAX to Amsterdam first for 3 days in Amsterdam, and then to my first European convention, FedCon, in Bonn. And so I just remember getting on the plane. They gave me two tickets, so I'm sitting there with a buddy. I brought a buddy of mine. It's an actor. He did some stuff on Next Generation. His name is Tim Lunibus. So Tim and I were sitting on the Lufthansa plane, and they made an announcement while we were still at LAX, we hadn't taken off yet, and they said, the flight attendant said, "Would passengers Nobu Tomasina and Tomohara and two Japanese names. Please come to the front of the plane. And so then my friend goes, he goes, to get your towel for your gas shower. You know, talking about the Nazis in Germany, right? So, and he said, it's starting right now. They're getting rid of all the minorities. Anyone who is not German looking is going to be, you know, eliminated right now. And I go, that's not funny. I go, stop saying that. Because as an American, when you watch television and movies, the Germans are always Nazis and they're always bad. They're never good, right? So it was kind of nervous for me. And then he's making this joke about this. And we finally get to Amsterdam. And this is the first time I've seen a European hotel room also. They said, they bring me into the room and they said, I said, where's the two beds? And they said, oh, it's right here. And he goes to the one bed and pulls it apart. And now there's two thin, thin beds, just the width of your body. That's it. Like if you move 1 inch, you're going to fall off. Okay. So I go, that's it? He's like, yeah, this is our two bed room. And I was like, no, let's say something bigger. But we kept going to bigger and bigger rooms. And finally, I just broke down. I said, just give me the largest room in the house. I'll pay the extra amount. I don't care. I was so tired because on that flight, I took melatonin. And melatonin works well if you're in your 20s, but it says after a while, if you're younger than 40, melatonin will do the opposite. Instead of making you sleep, it will keep you up. And so on that flight from LAX to Amsterdam, I actually had waking nightmares, and my whole body was shaking. I was like, oh my goodness. So when I landed in Amsterdam, I said, I have to have a natural way to calm down. So I wanted to look for a coffee shop, you know, in Amsterdam. And so they told me, they said, Johnny's Coffee Shop. And coffee is just the name for a place that has marijuana, basically, right? So I go to Johnny, I walk around the corner. I was on, I think the street was Ilanskracht. And I go to Johnny's Coffee Shop. And in there, Johnny is the guy that owns it, and one 18-year-old redhead Dutch kid named Marius, and then this old British guy that had retired from England, moved to Amsterdam, and was planning on smoking weed for the rest of his life, and he was sitting there, so Dave from England. So he's like, all right, nice to meet you, I'm Dave. I'm like, oh, hi, Dave, and then Marius and Johnny. And I'm looking around at Johnny's coffee shop, and I notice on the wall, there's a picture from a movie, Judge Dredd. You know Judge Dredd? And his autograph on there. And it was Sylvester Stallone on this air bike, right? This is the old Judge Dredd movie. And I look, and I said, Johnny, Sylvester Stallone was in your coffee shop smoking marijuana? He goes like, no, not Stallone, no. And it was on the back of the motorbike is, oh my God, what's his name from, oh my goodness, I'm blanking on his name. He played the gigolo guy. He played, no. Can you do a, who? No, not John Hoyt. He's a comedic actor, and he's very funny, and his name is, I'm blanking. If we do a Judge Dredd search of the original movie, can you see what the other characters are on there? What is his name? I can't believe I forgot his name right now. He's friends with Adam Sandler. He's in every Adam Sandler movie. Rob Schneider, yeah. So I go, Stallone was in your coffee shop? He goes, no, Rob Schneider. I'm like, oh. Rob Schneider. Well, that makes sense. That's much more sense. Rob was here. But I ended up seeing Rob Schneider like 20 years later at a grocery store in Los Angeles. And I walked up to him. I'm like, hey. And he's like, hey, what's up, man? I said, you and I are on the wall. Our autograph pictures are on the wall at Johnny's coffee shop in Amsterdam. He's like, oh, that's you from Star Trek. I go, yeah. So, all right. That's
okay.
It. Yeah. Yeah? Did you lose your...
No, yes, this one. Okay.
Okay.
It's the cable. Thank you very much. And I remind you that this year, Garrett is going to leave on Sunday morning. So tomorrow he will have his second Q&A session where probably you can talk about what you're going to do after DeepCon, which
sure.
will be very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
So stay tuned. Yeah. Thank you, Garrett, very much.
Thank you. Grazie, grazie.
Avete ascoltato Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache dalla galassia. Da un'idea di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafini, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof. Massimo De Santo. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.com, sul profilo Instagram Fantascientificast, sul canale Telegram Fantascientificast e sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/fsccommunity. Se siete particolarmente timidi, potete utilizzare la vecchia, cara e affidabile posta elettronica scrivendoci all'indirizzo redazione@fantascientificast.com. Tutte le puntate sono disponibili sul nostro sito e su tutti i principali servizi di streaming on demand. Se volete sostenere il nostro progetto offrendoci una birra romulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico, troverete tutte le informazioni e modalità nell'apposita sezione del nostro sito. Il podcast ha carattere esclusivamente ricreativo e divulgativo. Non ha alcun scopo di lucro e viene diffuso gratuitamente. Fantascientificast è una produzione amatoriale. Non si intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. Autorizzazione SIAE 5612I5359. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. Val 9000 e l'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augurano lunga vita e prosperità e vi danno appuntamento al prossimo episodio lungo la rotta di Kessel. E ricordate, la fantascienza finge di guardare dentro il futuro, ma in realtà guarda il riflesso della verità che è davanti a noi. Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache dalla galassia.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.